Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome. I'm so glad that you are here, where we are in the business of prescribing hope for healthy families. And I am really excited today because I've got one of my favorite guests, if not, I guess, really, I should say my favorite guest besides my daughter, right? But I have today a guest back for you, and my sister, my very own sister. I'm so excited to have her back on the show. My sister's name is Amber Brown, and she is, like me, a pediatric nurse practitioner. She is a mom, and she is here to talk about a really important topic, and one that is kind of tough. So I just want to give you a heads up, give you a disclaimer, give you a little warning here that we're going to be talking about abuse prevention and child abuse and how to protect your kids from abuse. Now, this may not be the episode for younger or more sensitive listeners, so I'm just giving you a moment to adjust your listening audience. We will talk about this in a very careful and thoughtful way, but these are some hard subjects, but not anything that we need to back away from. Now more than any time, as parents, we need to be aware of what the threats are that are out there in the world, and we need to be proactive in protecting our kids. And Amber is just the person to have this conversation with. Now, she and I have this conversation a lot, just as sisters and fellow moms talking about our own kids. But Amber also used to work in a children's advocacy center where she specialized in caring for children who were abused. And so we're just going to dive right in. Amber, I'm so grateful that you've taken time out of your busy nursing and mom schedule to come and have this chat with me today.
I'm really happy to be here. This is a topic I'm really, really passionate about. So I'm glad we're getting the opportunity to discuss it today.
And I know our listeners will benefit from your experience. So tell us a little bit about your experience and your work working with children who were abused. How did that influence your own parenting journey? And what can other parents learn from the experience you gained there?
Sure. So I think we should first kind of talk about what a children's advocacy center is. A lot of parents, I think, don't know that this kind of facility exists, but we have them in each county in Texas, at least. And it's a center we have that brings together all types of resources for children that have disclosed any type of abuse, whether that be physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse. Once there's an outcry made, whether to police or to CPS or to social work, they will contact our center, and we will have the child come there and have a forensic interview done by a trained, you know, somebody who works with children. Once they make that outcry, we congregate there with the police and CPS and social work, and then I will see them for a medical exam. That's where my portion came in. We also, after the medical exam is complete, we will make sure that we coordinate services with a therapist, a psychologist, psychiatrist, and make sure that that child gets the services that they need. So during that time that I worked there, I was working in Brazoria County at that time, and I did 576 exams in just a two-year span of time. And probably what the biggest thing that what shocked me was that out of those 576 exams that were completed, only one of those times was a perpetrator, a complete stranger. That means that 575 times that was somebody that the child knew. And that broke my heart. And it was really difficult. Those 2 years were tough. And they say that most people that do work in a child abuse setting only last in that field for about 2 years because it's heavy and it's hard. But I think one of the biggest things that I took home from that was that I am, as a parent, 100% in control of who I allow into my home and who I allow access to my children while they're in my home. And I've become very choosy and very picky about who I allow in my home and around my kids. I am a single mom, and I made the choice at that time just not to date. That is my personal choice. But I saw a lot of situations where the kids that were coming in, a lot of the perpetrators were paramours or partners of a parent. And I just made that choice for my kids, and it's not for everyone, and I understand that. But as parents, I think it's just really, really important that we understand that our kids are to be protected and that that is our 100% job given to us by God to protect these kids. And so that's something that I have been very passionate about. And even though I don't work directly in the field, it is still something that I want to talk to other parents about.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And I want our listeners to know that today we're going to talk about three concepts to empower parents to protect their kids from being abused. So we're not just going to scare you and leave you hanging. We are going to give you some actionable advice. And that first concept that I want to talk about is exactly what you were just sharing, Amber, that it's important for parents to know that any child is at risk for abuse. And I think that as parents, we kind of put stigma, and we use stigma to kind of put different people in different categories, different social categories, or different categories of thinking. We look at their story of abuse and we think, oh, well, I would never do that. Oh, I would never go there. Oh, I never would have put myself in that position. And that's okay to do that, because in a way we're just trying to reassure ourselves that we're safe, but it's normal to do it, but it's not going to be protective for our kids. And we have misconceptions about what abusers look like and who they can be. And we need to know that abusers are often very charming, they're disarming, they are deceptive. And that was so eye-opening what you just said. Of 576 exams, only once was it a stranger. So usually people who are seeking to abuse kids, they are people the kids know or they think they know. And I want to talk through a few case studies that have been in the news to show how that can happen. So I'm going to give you a scenario and then just let you respond to it. One of the cases that I've seen a lot about is a dad out in Washington who hosted a slumber party for a group of teenage girls. And he took them, I think, shopping and to maybe a movie, did some fun things with them, and then brought them home and made them smoothies, but was kind of acting weird about the smoothies and saying they needed to make sure not to exchange their glasses, that they needed to keep the same straw. And one of the girls got a little weirded out about it, honestly, and started texting her mother, which of course she couldn't get a hold of her mother, and finally got a hold of her friend when she noticed the other girls were just passed out. And her friend came and picked her up. She did something really important. She immediately told her mother about it when she got home, and they alerted the other parents and picked up these girls about 3 a.m. and took them to the emergency room. They tested positive for benzodiazepines. And I think as people are reading the story, you would think, oh, well, I wouldn't let my girls go to a slumber party where there was a dad. And maybe that's true. But I think, what can we learn from this, Amber, where we're looking at, this is a pretty normal occurrence where kids are having sleepovers or with a friend's parent who may be a perpetrator?
Sure. So I got a lot of stories like that at the Advocacy Center, where they were spending the night at somebody else's home. And Delphine, you and I have talked lots of times before about mm-hmm. sleepovers and how we feel about sleepovers. And in our home, they're just not allowed, because I have seen so many times where things have happened at a sleepover. And even if you know that family, you know, you may know the family very well, but there may be somebody else sleeping over with a sibling, or there may be, you know, other people there that you don't know. And just for me, and from what I've seen, sleepovers are just a no-go. It's just, mm-hmm. there's not enough control. There's not enough, I can't be there. I won't know everybody that's there. And so they are welcome to stay until, you know, it's nighttime, and then I can come and pick my kids up at that time. Since it's always been a rule in our house, it's never been an issue. But that's something that you would need to talk to your child about from even a younger age. You know, is that's just the rule in this house, and it's not going to be negotiable, and that's what we're going to do, and here is why. Because kids always need to know the why. They need to know the why and understand. This case obviously was horrific and something that you would never expect to see. And that's why it's something that you as a parent need to think about and talk about with your kids.
Well, and you're right, because I'm sure you could tell literally hundreds of stories that are just like this. And even for someone like me who didn't specialize in child abuse, I certainly saw my fair share of it. And even just recently, I was working with a school district in Oklahoma where there was a girl who was trafficked out of her home by a classmate's mother starting at the age of 11, and where parents just thought she was, you know, having a visit with a friend. Really, this mother was grooming her to be abused and exploited. And I think the important thing here is that abusers will always use tactics that are wrapped up in secrecy. And I want to come back to that in just a second and talk more about that. But let me go on to another scenario. I'll give you two of these, Amber. One is the Nickelodeon documentary that's going around, Quiet on Set, which is following some of the allegations of abuse that happened on the set. And one of those allegations is against a guy named Jason Handy, who would cultivate a relationship with aspiring child actors and then email them later, you know, on the premises of being a friend, and it would gradually become explicit. But what stood out to me about him in particular is that he was a very involved volunteer at his church. And then, you know, I think about a pastor we have interviewed here on the show before named Brian Haynes, who wrote a book, War in the Wilderness, talking about how one of the dad's friends who was in the ministry, who was a minister, abused his daughter. And he had no idea. He did not know this happened for a long time. And I think that sometimes, especially in church scenarios where we are more trusting, we have to realize that abusers come in and they can deceive us. And so what is your advice to, you know, how do we balance that? Like not being afraid of everybody in our church or everybody in our social circle, but also having a healthy skepticism and not allowing them such intimate access to our children.
Sure. I love what you said about healthy skepticism. I don't want anybody to leave today's, you know, show and to be parenting from a place of fear. That's definitely not what we're trying to cultivate here. But it is important to note that, yes, the people that perpetrate are very good at what they do. And if you notice all these news stories that come out, they are very charming. They're usually involved in some type of children's group. But here's the take home from that, is that adults should not be friends with children. That is not a friendship that should be cultivated. You can have a relationship where you are a, you know, a coaching relationship or a teacher relationship, but that person as an adult should not be a friend to your child, meaning they should not be texting them privately or emailing them privately or calling them privately. There is no place where that is appropriate for a teacher to be calling a child outside of any school hours or for a coach to be texting your child after a gymnastics practice. So that is something that you have to set up with your kids and an understanding that that is not an appropriate relationship, and that is usually how they get their foot in the door.
I think that what you just said is really wise advice, that adults should not be friends with children. Period. Now, there can be, like you said, mentorship, coaching, relationships, teachers, you know, things like that. But there is a power differential there that cannot be ignored. And you know what I see, Amber, is a lot of times, you know, you kind of get this little spidey sense as a parent that something is just a little bit off here, but you don't really have actionable evidence. I would just encourage you to not be shy about letting that mama bear out, letting that daddy tiger out, or whatever it is that helps you to be aggressively protective of your kids. Now, in all of the cases that we talked about, Amber, the parents did not know about the abuse that was happening in any of those cases. And of course, there are plenty of parents who enable or empower abuse of their kids, or they even abuse their kids themselves. But today on this radio show, I know we are talking to parents who care. We know they care, or they wouldn't be listening and thinking, how do I protect my kids? But the reason that I want parents to know that this can happen to anyone is that it reminds us all to be vigilant and to not let our guard down, and to make sure that the people that we're letting have access to our kids, we're going to our house or coming into our home, are people that we know really, really well, people that we have lived life with. The things that, I mean, we should have sat around a dinner table with these people. We should have, you know, gone to the hospital when they were sick and seen them at their best and their worst when we're talking about those things. And I think that that is, you know, we've got to keep that balance, maybe healthy skepticism is the right way. So that's the first point, is to know that any child can be vulnerable. But the second key point we're going to talk about next is that we have to talk to our kids about healthy body boundaries. And this can be really awkward for a lot of parents, and they want to do it, but they don't know what to say or how to do it. And when we come back, we're going to empower you and equip you to do just that. We'll be right back. Little things can make a difference. A little note, a little smile, the small stone that David hurled at Goliath, and precious little babies. When you sponsor an ultrasound at preborn, your gift, no matter how small, makes a difference in a big way. Who will this little baby become? What giants will this baby slay? How about the mother who was spared from unspeakable sorrow because of you? You never know the difference you're going to make with a donation of just $28 to introduce a mother to her child through ultrasound, which doubles a baby's chance at life. All you have to do is take a few small minutes to make a life-saving donation. Preborn will take it from there as their network of clinics rescues 200 tiny babies every day and shares God's love with mothers. Preborn has a 100% charity rating, so you can give with confidence. Get involved today by dialing #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome back to this really important conversation I'm having with my sister, who is also a pediatric nurse practitioner, a mom, and she worked in a child's advocacy center specializing in child abuse. She shared with us before the break, she did 576 exams in the 2 years she worked there, and only one time was that a stranger. So we've talked about how important it is to know that all kids are at risk for abuse. Now, I'm going to give you a little disclaimer here and tell you we're talking about some tough things today in talking about abuse. And so you may want to adjust your listening audience if you have younger or more sensitive ears around, because these are tough conversations to have, but they are critical because child abuse is happening at a rate I honestly have not seen in my entire career. Amber, I've seen since COVID, when we had so many kids who were isolated from their social safety supports and their social networks, and they were just on their digital devices. They were so vulnerable, and we're seeing abuse rates really go up. But we're not going to leave you here fearful, but we do want you to be faith-informed here. So we've talked about the fact that all children are vulnerable. And the second thing that we're going to talk about now, Amber, is talking to our kids before anything happens. And what do you think about, you know, how do you do that? How do we talk to our kids about their body boundaries, Amber, and telling them, you know, what that is? Now, for me, I don't like saying good touch or bad touch, because then if somebody experiences what they think is bad touch, then they think they did something bad or they are bad. I like terms like okay or not okay or appropriate or inappropriate. What advice do you have for parents to talk to their kids without really scaring them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that this actually starts much younger than people even think, not as far as just talking about body parts, but as far as giving your child a sense of autonomy over their own body starts very, very young. And what we see, and this is kind of the trend in parenting, is, you know, your kid hits somebody else or a toddler, you know, it happens, and they say, oh, you need to kiss or hug them and tell them that you're sorry. And that at a very young age, I know it sounds so silly, but it is teaching a child that they have to hug or kiss somebody when they upset that person. And what I have seen in a lot of these cases, that these children feel guilty, or that the abuser will make them feel guilty for something, and then the child feels like they owe them something. And that can sometimes open the door to touches that are not okay. And so in our household, I wanted to make sure that my kids know that when they say no, that that means no, even if it's something that is funny, like, you know, tickling, right? Or something that should be, you know, funny and silly. There are sometimes where that's okay and sometimes where it's not okay. And kids need to know that too, that anytime something in their body does not feel okay, number one, you don't owe me an explanation. If I'm tickling you and it was fine and then all of a sudden you don't like it, you can say no and I'll say okay and that's it. I do not force my kids to hug or kiss anybody. And that can be a little tricky, I understand, sometimes with parents, because they don't maybe they grew up in a household where you had to hug Uncle Billy every Christmas. You know, you've never seen him. You haven't seen him in, you know, a long time. But, oh, hug Uncle Billy. It's Christmas, you know, and they're making the kids do something with their body that they're not comfortable with. And that if the child refuses or I don't want to, that can embarrass the parent, right? But right. I have gotten to a point where my child is not responsible for my embarrassment. My child is not responsible for Uncle Billy's feelings. That child, my child, is responsible for how she feels about her body. And if she does not want to hug Uncle Billy, then I will say, oh, she's not up for a hug right now. Let's go get some, you know, cider or what have you. But starting that very early and letting the child know that they have autonomy over their body. And when they say no, that means no. And not forcing any type of physical contact, regardless of whether it's sexual contact or not. That's not what it's about. It's about letting your child understand that they have feelings inside their body that they may or may not understand. Like, maybe I don't want to hug this person. I don't know how to explain that as a three-year-old, but I know that my mom will sense that I'm not comfortable with it, and my mom will stand up for me whenever I am not comfortable standing up for myself, right? And so if I can sense that my daughter is uncomfortable with something, even if it's a very simple, playful something that someone is trying to do, like if her brother's trying to, you know, hug her or tickle her and she's just not feeling it at that time, she knows that she can just say no and that's it. Okay. The other thing is you have to know your child, right? And so some kids are very comfortable with affection and some are not. I have a child that is love language is not physical touch. So in the house, you know, we made that rule that, you know, that she doesn't like to be touched. So you need to ask first, even if it's something like a hug. Hey, is it okay if I hug you? And she has the right to say yes or no. And no one's feelings are hurt because we've already kind of set up that boundary. So that's something to big that you can start very, very early, like as toddlers, you know, or even younger, is not forcing any physical contact with any other person unless the child wants to do so. Unless it's their, you know, their aunt. They want to give a hug. They want to give a kiss.
I think this is such an important conversation we're having right now, Amber, because you're right. And this does happen, especially in family situations. And you said something that was really powerful, that my child is not responsible for my embarrassment. I mean, because our kids, mm-hmm. let's be honest, they will embarrass us. They will. We will be in embarrassing situations lots of times. They say things they shouldn't say. You know, they have accidents when they shouldn't have accidents. But this carries a different dynamic. And like you said, you know, it may seem something small. It may seem something silly. And there may be parents out there who are thinking, no, that's a gesture of respect. But I would challenge our listeners to think about, put yourself in a child's position and think about the messages we're sending as parents. If we say, yes, you have to hug Uncle Billy or you have to kiss Aunt Edna right on the lips, you know, because that's where she's trying to kiss you. And then, but then another adult is trying to do that same thing. And you're thinking, oh, well, this adult is initiating this physical contact. They want it. I can say no here, but I can't say no here. You know, they don't know that. They don't have the cognitive capacity. Their brains work very concretely. So if we teach them that, the honest truth is that can create a vulnerability when they are encountering adults like that. So I think that was such an important point. And the other thing that I think, you know, that you and I both have seen for sure, and you even more than me, is that abusers almost always use tactics of grooming, coercion, and threats to keep kids silent. I know you have seen, and I know I have seen, and even in some of these stories that we shared in the first segment about Jason Handy on Quiet on Set in the Nickelodeon documentary, or human trafficking in Oklahoma, or the pastor's daughter who was abused by a friend. These kids went years without saying anything, absolutely years. And I think part of this is because when something happens, they don't, if they haven't had conversation before, they don't understand what's happening to their bodies. And they are threatened by adults. They're scared and they feel like it's normal to not say anything. So how can we encourage our children to make an outcry early? Talk to them about this may happen to you. And even if an adult tells you, don't tell me, you can always tell me. How do we get them to do that?
Sure. So that's a good question too, because this actually starts a lot earlier than that conversation. Because what I can tell you from the kids that came into the center, a lot of them did not say anything for several reasons. Number one, they thought their parent would not believe them, which is heartbreaking. There were a lot of times, honestly, where the parent did not believe them. And that got to the point where there were sometimes where CPS had to get involved to remove that child because the parent was not going to be protective of their child. In order for a child to tell you a big secret, they have to trust that you're going to believe them. And so this is something that you would be developing for years, is a trust between you and your child. And the second thing I saw was that they were afraid to tell their parent because of how their parent would react. And so this is something I want to caution parents on. Anytime your child tells you anything, because they are gauging what is your reaction. And what we've known from years and years of research on child abuse is that children will just disclose out of nowhere something very small, something really little that happened, not anywhere near the full picture, to gauge your reaction. And then if you were okay with that disclosure, then they might tell you a little more. And then next time they might tell you a little more, which is why sometimes I had to have those children come back into my office several times before they got comfortable enough with me. They'd tell me a little bit on the first visit, and then that went okay. And then they would tell me a little bit more on the second visit, and then that went okay. Okay, nothing bad happened. So they feel more comfortable disclosing more. So number one is to establish a trust between you and your child that they know that they can tell you something. Engage your responses to how you respond to anything they tell you. If you immediately panic over small things and you are yelling and upset, and they're going to be very cautious about telling you something, right? Like, I can give you a practical example. I know this is so silly, but I actually got a phone call from my son today at school. And he said, "Hello, Mom." And I said, "What happened?" And he said, "I got my phone taken away at school today." And I said, "Okay, did you have it out when you were not supposed to?" And he said, "Yes, I did." And they took it, and they'll give it back at the end of the day. And I said, "Okay, thank you for letting me know." And that was the end of the conversation. We will have a whole nother conversation this evening. But kids need to get that feedback from you, where my mom's not going to panic and fly off the handle when I tell her something. This is not something, this is a course conversation that we'll have again. But that is so important. And when kids are gauging whether they feel like they can tell you something, so I know we want to talk about, this is either good touch, bad touch, okay touch, not okay touch. And yes, those are all important conversations to have. But the most important thing is to just start developing that trust and rapport with your child for a very long time, so that if something, God forbid, ever does happen, you're the safe person that they will come to disclose.
You just brought up a great point, because it is so applicable whether they get in trouble at school for their phone. I have been there myself with my kids, or whether it's something as serious as abuse, is they are looking at your reaction. And, sometimes when we react to news that we get, when they share something with us, we instantly just go from 0 to 60 emotionally. And we do, what were you thinking? Oh my gosh, what is going on? I can't believe that happened. Why didn't you tell me earlier, and really that is coming from a place of fear. If we're really honest, Amber, it's coming from a place of fear, and we are feeling protective. We feel like that mama bear in us is like, there is something that is threatening my child, and this is making me panic. But our kids do not differentiate our fear from our anger. To them, it looks the same. And when we come at them with a big response, they fear our anger. Is really then what happens, is we make them fear that. And then, they really care about what we think about them. And so they will gauge what they say, because they don't want to feel like they've done something wrong. And I want to go to a little bit too, Amber, a lot of times when kids are experiencing something, they do not understand what is happening. And so when they come to share something with you, they may not even have the language to describe what happened to them, especially if they don't even know the names of their body parts, or if they don't, understand what they've seen. Because a lot of times the truth is abusers will expose children to pornography as a grooming tactic, and they may not understand what they have seen in that way. They may not understand that, this just feels wrong. Like, I can't explain that. So walk parents through, if kids are coming to you, they're trying to tell you something, but they don't have the language for it. How can we as parents help them to understand and communicate that experience?
Sure. So the first thing we tell parents is just to to get curious. Actually, the first thing, let me start backwards. The first thing I would tell parents is to not say so much. because a child will disclose a lot more through silence than through being hit with 100 different questions. And that is going to be our first response and our first, you know, that of course that's going to come up first. Somebody, you know, if your child tells you something that you don't think is quite right, well, when did that happen? And when did that happen? And how did it happen? Why did that happen? And how, and a child can't, they can't do that. So I would just say the first thing is just to get curious, but also to just sit and listen. The other thing is if your child is young, that having that type of conversation through play is very, very effective. There were very few times when I was having a conversation with these children that would come into the advocacy center. I didn't just sit across from them in a chair. Like, how scary would that be to talk to an adult that you don't know about something very private that happened to you? So most of the time we do things through play, you know, so we would start playing games or we would do a puzzle or, and the child will just start talking. And through that natural play, things will just kind of start to come out and they will tell you little bits and pieces about what's going on. But I think that your reaction is probably the best indicator of what your child will be comfortable telling you. So you're going to have to find a way in that moment to take a breath, to relax, and to let that child disclose at their pace. And then just get curious and ask a couple of questions and understand that children will not tell you the full story in the first conversation, that this is something you're going to have multiple conversations about until you really get to the root. And a child will never know why. So asking a child why, it's not a question they can ever understand. And maybe a question that they're dealing with why, for a very, very long time. So remaining calm, remaining empathetic, opening, listening, those are going to be the most important things in those type of conversations.
I agree with that. And I think that we need to honor, and I want to talk more about this after the next break, but we need to honor that voice of discomfort that our kids have. You know, we've got to balance it because we don't want them to be scared to death of the world and think every potential person they encounter might be a predator. But Amber, you and I have both seen the aftermath of children who experience abuse, and it is so devastating. And I would rather parents be a little more overcautious than to just, you know, dismiss threats that happen. And I'll give an example of a girl that came to me in our church youth group. I was a sponsor for an event, and she just started asking me some very vague questions about one of the dads that was sponsoring. And it wasn't really anything specific. It was just kind of, you know, just asking me general questions about this. And it raised enough alarm. I was able to have a conversation with her about it. And basically what she told me was that after I said, okay, it seems like you might have a concern here, I want you to know this is a safe place and you can tell me about a concern you have. And basically what she told me was that when they sat in a circle to do their Bible study, that he let his leg touch hers. And it made her uncomfortable. And we were able to have a conversation with that. I'll pick up with the rest of the story when we come back. And we are also going to talk about the current dialogue that's going around about kids experiencing abuse, but not realizing it was abuse until later. What do we think about that? Well, you'll find out when we come back.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at AFR.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Hey, friends, and welcome back to this really important, serious, but just critical conversation I'm actually having with my sister, Amber Brown. She is a pediatric nurse practitioner and child abuse specialist, and we're talking about how to protect our kids from abuse. April is Child Abuse Awareness Month, and so that is why we are talking about this. And now more than ever, we're seeing kids at risk for abuse. And we want to make sure that you as a parent feel equipped and empowered and informed enough that we can protect our kids to the very best of our ability. So far to recap, if you're just joining us, we've talked about the fact it's important to know that any child is at risk for abuse and every parent needs to be vigilant. The second thing that we talked about is that we need to talk to our kids before anything happens. Talk to them about healthy body boundaries and that they can always come to us with anything and tell us about any uneasy feeling that they're having, and we will honor that. Now, before the break, Amber, I was just telling you about a girl who had come to me, a teenage girl in a youth group setting. Now, for me as a grown-up, I know that it is not okay for a grown man's leg to touch a teenage girl's leg. And whether that was intentional or unintentional, it was inappropriate. And so I immediately went to the leader of that group and disclosed my concern, and that had an immediate conversation. And then there was accountability in there. So there are some protective measures that you can put into place. And I want to talk about that just for a little bit in church settings, or maybe things like, you know, after school activities, or clubs that you may be involved with, or sports teams. But one of the things I would say, Amber, is that no adult should ever be alone with a child that is not theirs without having another adult present. There always need to be two adults present at any given time. Not only does that give protection for the child, but that gives protection for the adult from false accusations or from being in a situation where there is no other witness to talk about what happened. But what do you think are some other things that parents can do in those kinds of settings to make sure that their kids are protected?
Sure. So I always talk to my kids about what to expect before they go into any certain situation. But also, I am the parent that will just show up right in the middle of anything, and I have no problem doing this. I will show up in the middle of the school day and say, hey, can I peek in our classroom? I will go to my daughter's gymnastics practices. I'm going to be the parent that's there. Because when there is a predator, I say predator, and it sounds so scary, but honestly, these people look totally normal. You know, when there is somebody who has an interest in children, let's say it that way, they are looking for somebody that is not going to say anything, whose parent is not present, who, you know, they feel like they can get away with it. If I'm the mom that's constantly looking through the glass, you know, I don't pop up. But being a parent that is present and volunteering, volunteer at your kid's school, and you will be able to pop in at different times. You know, I'll go and sit through some of my daughter's practices. I will be there, and I will show up, and I will make sure, you know, that whoever the adults are in my kids' lives, that they know that I'm a mom that's going to be involved, and I'm going to know if something is going on. And also just knowing your child, and you can tell on your child's face if something is uncomfortable for them. And to honor that, no matter whether they have a reason why or not, it does not matter to me. All my child has to say is, I'm not comfortable, and I will pull her. And that's okay. Let's go. Okay. Because we would do the same thing for a friend, right? Like, let's say you're walking through a city together and you're just enjoying the day, and you walk down the street and your friend says, I don't know. Something just feels weird. I don't think we should walk down that way. We wouldn't say, well, why? Well, if you can't say why, I mean, it looks like a nice street. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. We've gone down here before. We wouldn't do that to an adult, so I certainly wouldn't do that to a child, right? If you have a feeling in your body that is uncomfortable, I'm going to help you honor that.
And so let's talk about children making an outcry, where you talked about earlier, and I agree, a lot of times they'll give you a small snippet to kind of gauge your reaction and to feel like, you know, is this okay to say? And many times they've been told repeatedly, don't tell anybody, don't tell anybody, don't tell anybody. So if a child ever makes an outcry, I think we just, for our own integrity here, Amber, we have to say that you need to believe that child and notify the authorities immediately. Mm-hmm. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Do not do anything until you have made a notification to the authorities. But Amber, let's back that up a little bit and walk a parent through if their child makes an outcry or another child comes to them and makes an outcry. What should be the next steps?
Anytime a child makes an outcry, you should immediately make a phone call to the police. But I would first talk to my child and explain to them, here is what's going to happen next. Okay. Know that you know, that I will be with you the entire time, okay, that you are safe, that I'm glad that you told me, and that we're going to take care of this. But the first thing should be you do have to make a call to law enforcement. Now, if you live in an area that has a child advocacy center, they will do their best to coordinate with the advocacy center. And the whole purpose is that the child doesn't have to repeat their story over and over again, which can be very traumatizing. So what law enforcement sometimes will do is just to make an appointment with the advocacy center where your child will meet with a forensic interviewer who is specialized working with children. And that will be videotaped. So that way the police can see it. I, as a medical provider, could see it. The therapist, the CPS worker, and the social worker, usually they're all in one place at one time. We coordinate that, and they're watching the interview from a different room. That way your child doesn't have to outcry multiple times or have to, you know, say what happened, which the other downside to repeating things over and over again is that when children are asked to repeat a story over and over again, sometimes the details may change a tiny bit, but it's just dependent on their reaction and their emotions to that. But every county around Texas definitely has advocacy centers, and there are some around the, there's lots around the United States too. But that first phone call needs to be to law enforcement, who will then coordinate care with your area's child advocacy center. If somebody else, not your child, makes an outcry to you, then you need to contact that parent immediately, but you would still need to contact law enforcement because there is no guarantee that that parent will report that. And when a child discloses something to you, it does need to be reported to the authorities.
And, you know, this is, I think every parent's worst nightmare is sexual abuse. You know, a predator grooming and abusing their child. And then, of course, we do see incidences of physical abuse. But, Amber, the research shows that actually some of the most devastating abuse can be emotional abuse and neglect. And I think that, you know, sometimes when, if a child comes to you and they tell you, hey, this happens to me, and they describe, you know, a physical act, that is easy to wrap your head around. That's easy to pick up the phone, call the authorities to sound all of the alarms. But if a child is describing something like emotional neglect or abuse, that can be a little more tricky. What advice do you have about that?
A lot of times the emotional neglect will also come with some type of physical neglect. Doesn't mean, I mean, it is still abuse, but you may not see marks on this child's body, you know. But what is more common to see is them asking you often for food or knocking on your door asking to play with your kids off very often or coming around to your house at different hours that may not be perfectly appropriate, you know, like late at night, or the child comes and they're not dressed appropriately for the weather, or you know, that is still a form of emotional neglect. And what we found through lots of research is that of all types of abuse, the emotional neglect can be some of the most painful because what these kids feel like and what they have disclosed is, I wasn't even worth my mom hurting me. She thought of me as less than nothing. And those kids need such therapy and they need such help, but it is so difficult to prove. So I would say the first thing would be, if you're able to, is to help the help that child to take care of some of those basic needs. I've always wanted to be the house where my kids' friends can come by and they know that they will get food and they will get something to drink, and it's a safe house, it's a safe place, right? So I may have those kids that come by often, and if something just kind of sparks in the back of your mind, like just you know, they're coming around a lot, or I'm seeing them after dark, and where's your mom? And you know, it's okay to ask the child a couple of those questions. But if you really feel like this child is being emotionally or physically neglected, you can make a call to law enforcement, but they may or may not do anything. They may refer you over to CPS to make a CPS referral.
Which you can do anonymously sometimes online.
Absolutely.
And that can happen. And of course, you know, Amber, we don't have time to get into the balance of, you know, some of those overzealous things, you know, where kids are playing outside in their front yard and the neighbor calls CPS. You know, there is definitely a balanced argument to be had here. But for today, I just want to be clear that we're focusing on looking for those children who do experience abuse, because the tragedy of what we see a lot of times is that they experience it for years and they make multiple outcries and multiple venues and nothing is done. And that can be just more emotionally devastating for sure. And I want to give our listeners a preview on a future show. We'll be talking about the counterbalance of this. But for today, we're talking about abuse, real abuse that's happening. And Amber, we both know too that it is very uncommon for a kid to make an outcry of abuse that is not true. That just very, very rare that happens. And there's a lot of dialogue that's going around in stories right now talking about, you know, kids experiencing abuse when they're children and not realizing until later that it was abuse. And I see a lot of vitriolic honestly, comments about this, but, you know, some of the things that I think to start with, and I want to hear your perspective, is that we know that trauma impacts your memory. It literally damages your memory. And there are ways that our brain works to protect our spirit by repressing our memory, because I think, honestly, God knows we cannot handle all of that pouring into our brain at once. And so we know that a memory can be impacted. But what do you think about this dialogue going on?
Yes, I have seen this a lot, that a lot of people are making TikTok videos about it, just looking back and thinking, this didn't happen to me, but this is what I'm seeing on the videos. I was 15, and this 23-year-old counselor at, you know, my school or at my, you know, sports complex was texting me and calling me, and we would talk every single day. And I'm looking back at it and realizing I was groomed, right? Like, and they did not realize in that time that that was a very inappropriate relationship. But like we said, that children only disclose a little bit at a time. Your brain can only disclose a little bit at a time. So once you have that first realization, where it will come as an absolute shock to your system that I was groomed and abused, and your body has to take some time to process that. And once your brain realizes, okay, I gave her that little bit of information, she's okay with that, you may start experiencing some repressed memories start to pop back up. And they will come, usually they'll come, you know, every once in a while, as your brain realizes that you are processing through those emotions. But what a shock. Can you imagine looking back and thinking, I had no idea? But this goes back to two points that we already made, is that one, adults are not friends with children. Mm-hmm. And there should be no parent that is allowing a 23, 24-year-old man, it doesn't matter what their relationship is in your child's life, whether it's, you know, a baseball coach, a gymnastics coach, that should be calling or texting your child. And so when people have that realization of, I was groomed and abused, and why did nobody protect me? And that's the second layer that usually comes with people who are victims of abuse, is that feeling of, I feel completely unprotected because nobody was there to tell me as a child, as a 14-year-old, you know, 13-year-old, this is not appropriate. And that adds a whole nother level to the healing process. But know that when you are experiencing those memories, that they will come in waves. And that is just your brain protecting your emotions until you're able to process through them.
Yes. And the other impact of this is that when we're talking about adults abusing children, it can be really confusing for kids because they may think, this is a person I trust. And a lot of times they may see, this is a person my parents trust. Like, my parents are leaving me with this person because they trust them. And this is an adult. This is who I get spiritual guidance from. This is who teaches me. This is who coaches me. And if they've never had any of those physical interactions before, or sexual experiences, to be really candid about it, it can be really confusing for what they think. And so I think it's important to make sure that, you know, we understand that. Well, Amber, we could talk about this for a long time, but we're just at the last minute here. Can you give some last words of encouragement for parents not to be living and marinating in a fear-saturated world, but how can they be empowered?
Absolutely. So when I was working in child abuse, I was terrified all of the time, just because that's all I saw all day, every day, was these type of cases. But God does not want us to parent from fear. And when we parent from fear or make any decision from fear, it often is not the right decision because it's based in emotion, right? And what I had to step back and realize was that I, even as the most vigilant parent, I cannot possibly be with my children 24 hours a day, every single day. So what am I going to do in the meantime? And then I look up and say, I have a very big God who can be there 24 hours a day with my children, watching over them, looking over them. So number one, I would say, educate yourself. You know what the signs of abuse are. Know what to look for. You know, yes, you can feel empowered by that knowledge rather than terrified or scared by that knowledge. Number two, cultivate a great relationship with your child so that if anything does happen, they're going to tell you. And you can have that conversation and you can move through how to get them out of that situation. And number three, realize that my Lord will fight for you. God says that in Exodus, right? He will fight for you. Cover your children in prayer. Every night, even after, like, I put my daughter to bed till she's 8. And after she falls asleep, I will physically lay hands on her and ask for God's protection over my children, because I cannot be there, but He always can.
He always can. Amen. And if you need help, you can call the National Hotline at 800-656-4673.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Faith, family, freedom. American Family Radio.